Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Brian Fall from the Federal Defenders in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, on behalf of Ramel Lewis, who appeals the District Court's denial of his motion to suppress. There are two instances where the District Court determined that Mr. Lewis consented to law enforcement. The first was the initial consent to enter Mr. Lewis's residence, and the second was consent to search or enter the bedroom where the contraband was eventually discovered. Mr. Lewis objects to both findings by the District Court that consent was present.
Would you agree that these underlying factual findings about who said what at the door and whether there was an invitation for all three people to walk in with respect to the consent to enter the apartment, that's something we review quite deferentially?
Yes, Your Honor, that is something that is reviewed with deference to the magistrate judge who made the actual finding. Mr. Lewis's argument does not turn entirely on this sort of he said, who said, but rather on the totality of the circumstances. It was clear error for the district court to determine that consent was there. With regard to the consent to enter, it's interesting to note that the security guard was the only person to have an interaction, a verbal interaction with Mr. Lewis at the door. Detective Endersign, at the supplemental appendix at page 37, indicates only Lucas conversed with Lewis before they entered in the apartment.
But it was clear to Mr. Lewis that the other two people were with security guard Lucas.
Yes, I think that it's clear that they were there behind him and not there.
They weren't like just hiding in the corridor and leaping out and jumping in or anything. I thought they showed their ID, didn't they?
They did. I don't think there, at this point, there's an indication that Mr. Lewis did not understand that these were law enforcement officers. However, law enforcement did not clearly indicate their intent to enter the apartment other than to cross the threshold themselves. There was not an instance where they indicated by a may I come in or some indication demonstrably that they wanted to enter before actually crossing the threshold.
Why does there have to be a verbal exchange when one might think if three people are standing there in front of the apartment and they make motions as if to come in, that if you don't want them to come in, maybe you should say, you know, only Lucas or something.
Right. And I understand you. And I think that there does not have to be any sort of verbal interaction, but rather just some clear indication of intent to enter, which then allows the resident an opportunity to object. Once they've crossed the threshold, they've entered the apartment, and consent is no longer of issue. I mean, the entrance would be without consent and be unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment.
Or the entrance would be with consent, and at that point, maybe further searching would, you know, sort of your second point would still need to be justified, but anything in plain view at that point would be fair game.
Correct. And the failure to object, again, I don't think is completely appropriate to this situation. The cases that the government cites, Walls and Wessler, are cases where first law enforcement actually asks or indicates their interest to come into the residence or their interest to search. It's not a case where Lewis was never given, they had never indicated to Lewis that they were interested in entering. They just walked in behind the security guard. And so there's a factual difference that I think is important when talking about a failure to object. You can't object to something that you aren't given an opportunity to consent in the first instance. It's the objection comes after the fact, and I think at that point it's vitiated by the officer's actions. With regard to the search, this determines on what the officers felt or what was indicated by a statement, a question from law enforcement, do you have an identification? A response from Lewis, it's on my dresser, on a shoebox in the bedroom. Law enforcement and the government argues that that constitutes consent to go to the bedroom. Under the facts of this case, they are not.
Just to look at it for a minute from the government standpoint, he could have said, yes, I have ID, period. He doesn't do that. He gives a fairly detailed description of where it is in his bedroom. Now, why would you do that if you weren't pointing somebody in the direction of, when you go in the bedroom, look over here and you'll see it on the shoebox and blah, blah, blah. And he doesn't quite put it that way, but why couldn't the officers have rationally inferred from the description that this was an invitation to go get it?
Because, Your Honor, in this case, we have a man who's sitting in his boxer shorts at a kitchen table with law enforcement officers behind him. I think it's more reasonable to conclude that they're wanting to know his identification. He's offering an explanation of, hey, why I don't have it here. I don't have it with me.
Why couldn't he just say yes? I'm not suggesting he has to sit there mum, but if they say, we want to see your identification, he could say, I don't have it with me. It's not here tucked in my boxers or whatever he wants to say. I don't understand why he has to give an elaborate description of where it is.
Right, and I understand that, perhaps that would have been the better course, but again, we're talking about a presumptively unreasonable search where the government bears the burden of proving that this is consent.
Well, right. We're talking about, did the district court rationally find that these facts, which I guess we all agree pretty much with the statement of the facts, do they amount to consent in the eyes of a reasonable observer?
Right. And if we, I guess if you were to extrapolate this further, if Lewis were sitting on his front stoop smoking a cigarette when law enforcement encountered him, would that same response allow them to go into the bedroom and search for the identification? Or if he was out in the parking lot in his car, would the same statement allow law enforcement to go into the house and search for the identification? I think in all those cases, it's an indication of why he doesn't have identification with him presently. Could he have worded it better? Sure. But again, we shouldn't infringe on his Fourth Amendment rights because he didn't word his response to law enforcement question just properly. In any of these cases, all Detective Crivello, Detective Endersign had to say was, could I go get it? That's not an undue burden to place on law enforcement. And in fact, they wouldn't even have to say anything specifically. They could perhaps just say, point and gesture to, in this one over here, and that could, we could find consent on that basis. But the magistrate judge's decision, which is at Appendix 16, just says that law enforcement asked if he had his identification. He said it's in the bedroom on a shoebox. Instantly, Detective Crivello went back into the bedroom, pulled out the identification, said we have a C1, I believe it was, and placed Mr. Lewis under arrest. On those facts, it's not reasonable to assume that that statement was a consent to go into search my bedroom, especially when Lewis presumably knew there was contraband in the room. You wouldn't think that he would intend to offer consent to search when he could have just said no, or he could have just said yes, knowing what was in the bedroom.
Can I ask you a question about the practice in the Eastern District now?
Yes.
In this case and in the Figueroa appeal that we heard a couple of cases ago, in both situations there's a motion to suppress. The magistrate issues a fairly detailed, lengthy report and recommendation, goes to the district court, there are objections made, and in each case, it's Judge Randa as the district judge in both cases. In one paragraph, he adopts the recommendation without really addressing any of the objections. Is that the usual practice, or... I always thought the district judges engaged in a little more analysis of these sorts of suppression issues. And I don't been a while since I've been back in that district. But
I would say that this is not unreasonable or unusual, Your Honor, that this is, tends to be the course. There are exceptions, of course, where you get a more detailed explanation or adoption of or denial of the magistrate judge's recommendation. I think when there's the district court is not going to accept the recommendation, obviously you have more of a detailed finding by the district court, but generally we get these some summary dispositions or summary adoptions of the orders.
By all the judges in the district?
Generally. Some tend to do more than others, but.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Ms. Domasek?
May it please the Court, my name is Bridget Domasek. I'm an Assistant United States Attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and I appear today on behalf of the appellee of the United States of America. Good morning, Your Honors. The District Court correctly concluded that the defendant voluntarily consented to two Milwaukee Police Department detectives entering the apartment and the bedroom within that apartment on July 12, 2008.
So, Ms. Domasek, I'm a little bit more concerned about the second of these points than the first. You know, I can, you know, obviously I'll think about them both, but here's Lewis sitting at his kitchen table, as I understand this record, wearing his boxers, and all he says is, yes, I have ID, and before anybody can say boo, this police officer leaps up and goes into his bedroom. I mean, how can we infer consent from that? He didn't have time to indicate consent, lack of consent, or anything.
Your Honor, courts are to consider the totality of the circumstances when determining whether consent has been given.
Yeah, and I've just described the totality of the circumstances to you, and we need to be confident that there's consent for that entrance, because that's what the whole case turns on. That's where the sawed-off shotgun is found. That's where...
There are additional circumstances, though, that are relevant in assessing the totality of the circumstances. And here, these facts are that when the detective asked for identification and the defendant immediately responded that it was in his room, the defendant gave specific detailed instructions about where this identification was.
Well, was it is this rationally understood as instructions, or is this rationally understood as Mr. Lewis trying to say, you know, kind of, I'm legit, you know, yes, I do have ID, you know, I'm fine, you know, and with an expectation that before anybody goes and barges into his room, they'll say, is it okay with you if we go into the room and get it? What's so hard to clarify the consent? Just every time somebody describes anything, you just assume you can go?
No, clearly no, but... In assessing the totality of the circumstances, consent can be expressed or implied, and here it was clearly implied. I mean, there's the specific instructions.
Mr. Paul doesn't think it was implied at all, much less clearly.
But the consent came from the specific detailed instructions, but there are also other relevant circumstances, and if I could address them. The defendant was not repeatedly asked for consent to enter that bedroom.
Did he have time, though? I mean, is my timeline right? It's on the shoebox in my bedroom, and then 15 seconds later, Officer Crivello is in the bedroom.
I believe that your timeline is pretty accurate, because the facts indicate that all this happened within about a minute of entry into the apartment. But
so there's no time for... repeated haranguing.
Well,
if Crivello had stood there for a minute, maybe Mr. Lewis would have finished his thought.
I don't know that there's any evidence that he didn't have time to finish his thought, but there is evidence that from the defendant's vantage point, he could see, or a person standing in that position could see, the detective approaching the bedroom, and that there was an opportunity to at least say, You misunderstood me. What I meant was, I have it, and I said that to be, as Your Honor commented, to be legitimate, to let you know that, yes, I do have ID, but I did not say it, meaning you can go into my room.
Does he have any time to say something like, do you want me to go get it?
There's, you know, the record actually is silent with respect to that.
I don't think he does have time to say that.
But there are other significant factors. I mean, the fact that he was not repeatedly requested for entry into the bedroom, the fact that the There were no threats made once the officers were inside the apartment. Their guns were not drawn. They didn't say, if you give us consent, we promise to X, Y, and Z. The defendant, when he had the opportunity to view the detective, did not correct him, and at no time did he object. And this consent was...
But, you know, again, I would place more weight on that if the timeline were a little more extended. I'm having trouble placing a whole lot of weight on his lack. I mean, I have this image of him almost like a cartoon saying, wait, you know, as Crivello jumps off into the bedroom. And, you know, pulling it back at that point without making a great scene might have seemed unrealistic to him.
Well, Judge, even if that is true, that is one factor to be considered in assessing the totality of the circumstances. You could say that
But your only factors really are that he gives a particularly detailed description. That's it, really. And if that detailed description is reasonably inferred as instructions, which is the word you're using, that's one thing. If that reasonably detailed description is not read that way, then maybe there was no consent. I'm not getting too much help out of the rest of the circumstances you're pointing to.
Well, respectfully, there was also the opportunity to object because there is evidence that the defendant could see the detective approaching the bedroom from where he was. So perhaps the timeline was short, but that does not indicate that he did not have an opportunity to correct the defendant or the detective in his understanding about what he meant.
So he should have called after the detective, I object, or something.
I think he could have said various things that would have indicated, I don't like what you're doing, and when I told you this, I did not mean that you could go into my bedroom.
Okay.
The district court also correctly concluded that the consent into the entry of the bedroom was voluntary. As I mentioned earlier, it was not given in response to repeated requests for entry. There were no threats made. There were no weapons drawn. There were no promises made in exchange for consent. And all of this happened while the defendant was in his own home. Yes, he was wearing his boxer shorts, but he was in a place that was familiar to him. It happened during the daylight hours. He was not subjected to harsh interrogation. He was not closely restrained, and he was not in custody at the time that he gave the consent. So for all these reasons, the district court correctly concluded that the defendant's consent to enter the bedroom was voluntarily given.
You want to spend I appreciate the concern Judge Wood has expressed. I share it as to the second point, but I have some continuing unease about the initial entry and the ruse connected with that. Do you want to speak to that? I mean, the officers are there, but our cases usually, when there's a reason other than the one described by a police officer, the person knows it's a police officer. Here he thinks it's something probably, I think reasonably one could conclude, was connected with his tenancy.
Your Honor, it's clear from at the point that the defendant opened the door that the security guard was the person who requested consent to entry, and he did say something to the effect of, I would like to discuss a matter related to your tenancy. At that point, the detectives identified themselves as law enforcement, indicated that they were with the security guard, and they were clearly visible from the defendant's vantage point at the front door. There is no evidence that there was a ruse.
When they knock and he makes inquiry, who's there? Who responds?
Lucas responds, the private security guard.
Right.
But there's no evidence that this was a ruse. And in fact, there's actually evidence that the security guard was legitimately concerned about his safety. He was responding to complaints that shots had been fired from this apartment.
Let's just take that a little bit further. Suppose we have a neighborhood which is viewed by law enforcement as drug infested, for want of a better term, because of arrests. It's a low-income neighborhood, and we have a regular security guard entry requested because of different violations, noise, whatever. And understandably, the security guards would always like police officers to be in attendance, because one never knows what's behind the door. Would we sanction regular attendance by police officers who really are looking for something other than a tenant violation, gaining entrance the way they did here?
Well, I believe that it depends on the circumstances. And in here, I think that the circumstances clearly justify the security guard bringing the detectives with him. Specifically, the complaint that was received with respect to the firearm.
But that was, I'd understand that if that happened immediately. But wasn't there a pretty good gap in time?
Approximately 2 or 3 days there was. But unlike drugs, which are, you know, have the tendency to, you know, be disposed of very quickly, that's not necessarily true with a firearm. And in this case, the evidence was that there was a firearm fired from the window of that apartment into the parking lot. And so it was reasonable for them to believe that that firearm could still be in that apartment just a couple of days later.
What about a month later?
That's hard to say, but I think that in response to your question here, whether the security guard was justified in bringing the detectives with him, clearly he was because he was concerned about his safety.
No, I appreciate that, but I'm just wondering what license such a decision would give to, law enforcement generally, understandably wanting to patrol troubled areas. And, I understand your position.
Well, here, and I think it's also important to remember that there is, I see my time has expired. May I continue?
You may conclude.
Here, I think it's also important just to remember that the evidence that the detective that had been relayed to the detectives was also important to an issue of illegal activity. It was just an issue of, hey, I'd like you to come with me. They actually had evidence that something illegal was going on, so they might actually have had reason to be there on their own, independently, without the security guard. For all these reasons,
not for a search warrant.
Not for a search warrant. No, I would not submit that in this case. For all these reasons, the government respectfully requests that this court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you very much.
Mr. Fall, your time had run out, but we asked a fair number of questions, and you had to answer Judge Evans' piercing commentary on practices in the Eastern District, so we'll give you another minute.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to touch briefly on something addressed by Ms. Domacek in response to this court. The fact that Mr. Lewis was seized at the time he was asked where his identification was, I think that is instructive as to how he thought it would be appropriate for him to respond. There's no question that he's seized at the time he's asked that question, and I don't think he'd feel comfortable getting up to stop them or even making two gregarious of a response. In fact, I think he probably felt it was better just to sit tight and not make a scene, and he was better off that way.
Can I ask you a question? Judge Flom has rung my bell here. But if we take this case and decide that the search is okay, would you expect us to write a one-paragraph decision and say, we agree?
No, Your Honor, I would hope that there would be more than that.
So why isn't that accepted practice in the district court? I don't understand.
I think, Your Honor, that in
that's
most...
That's the way it used to be.
Right. I think that what happens in these cases is that the plea agreement is generally entered, or notification of plea agreement is entered before the district judge makes the findings. Seeing as that there's a conditional plea entered, I think that at that point, maybe...
But still, a conditional plea is even more of a signal that the... search issues are going to be...
I would agree, Your Honor. And before I leave here, I just want to note that there was another issue about the legality or whether or not there was reasonable suspicion for the seizure that took place that I didn't get to address. That is covered fully in the briefs of the parties. I'd like the court to address that as well. And for the, based on the arguments made here today as well as those in the briefs, we would ask that this court vacate the judgment conviction and reverse the order of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Hall.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will take a short recess.